10173, reel 2.
Okay. I might have had a choice then of serving on a hospital train in France, on a hospital ship in the Mediterranean, or at the headquarters, the ambulance service in Dunkirk. I didn't want to serve in a unit hospital. At that time, the unit had a large hospital at Dunkirk, and of all funny things, a hospital on a barge on the canal near Dunkirk. They were staffing two ambulance units for the French army, and they were responsible for the ambulance work in the Dunkirk area, which extended up to the front at Nieuport, a very quiet section of the front, very waterlogged. And I applied to drive an ambulance, which is what I always wanted to do, and the OC was a cab road. I knew him, he knew that I had done a lot of driving. I had even been employed when I was working in London to go as far as Aberdeen to fetch cars donated to the unit for conversion to ambulances. It wasn't really my job, but the first person they put on to doing it turned a valuable car over on the North Road, so they didn't employ him any longer. Didn't employ him any longer for fetching cars, and the job was put on to me as an extra, and I enjoyed it.
Yes, I was wondering, you know, how easy it was to get the ambulances together in World War One, you know, to convert vehicles into ambulances. Was it quite a difficult task, do you think?
It was expensive, but I don't think really difficult. Some of them converted easily, some of them didn't convert. I as part of my job in London, looked after the providing the motor spurs and tyres, and seeing that any new cars were convoyed to the docks, and when I arrived in Dunkirk in February 1917, I think, I found, not entirely to my surprise, that I was excused any of the ordinary duties, which, like scrubbing floors or work in the kitchen, which raw recruits normally had to do, I think it was appreciated that I was giving up officer status to become an ordinary ambulance driver, and they found me an ambulance straight away. So I started straight away driving an ambulance for what became the Dunkirk Dunkirk Ambulance Service, which was serviced entirely by the FAU, and I was rather nominally head of a convoy of six cars doing the work in the Dunkirk area, which was just the sort of job I wanted. We it involved taking the colonel and medical officer around the army depot, medical depots in Dunkirk, with a very large contingent of dockside workers, Chinese, Egyptians, even Fijians, working in the Dunkirk area. Dunkirk, when I first got there, was a very big center for munition supply to the British Army. It was brought in to the Dunkirk docks, and stored there, presumably, and distributed by road, and I think even by canal, of northern France, the Ypres sector. That made it very vulnerable to night attack by aeroplanes. Every time at full moon or near full moon, we had a hectic time at night, the result was actually that after about 6 months of bombing and long-range shelling from a very large naval gun, a 21-inch, I think, gun, which used to drop shells at intervals into the Dunkirk area, they put one right in the middle of our hospital compound without killing anybody. But the result was eventually that they gave up bringing munitions in because it was too dangerous. The first day they got the big naval gun working, it was the first time I heard a shell. I was just just getting out of bed, I think, and suddenly there was a noise like an express train going by. We didn't know what it was, but it was followed by a tremendous explosion about a mile away on the docks, which smashed most of the little glass we still had in our windows, and we realized that the Germans had got a field gun to work and had got the range. I remember going down. I was called out straight away with my ambulance, went down to the dock area, where the first of these naval shells had landed alongside a billet, I think killing and wounding about 20 men. It took them a little time to get the casualties out for me to take to hospital, and I can remember with amusement seeing two elderly Frenchmen working a hand fire pump, trying to put out the fire on a railway truck full of shells. I rather wondered at what point a truck of shells would go off. However, they got the fire out and it didn't explode. And then I got away very quick in the morning without filling my radiator, so I had my radiator filled up by the French fire pump. And by that time they'd got the first of the shell casualties out. We'd had a number of incidents at night from bombing, but that was the first use of the naval gun, which pumped shells at intervals into the Dunkirk area, until I suppose it needed repair. It went. It would send a shell over about once in 10 minutes. You always knew when it was coming, which was helpful, because you could see by night you could see the flash of the gun 30 miles away. You could hear it, and then you'd hear the shell coming over and a bump as it exploded, and the noise of the explosion. Then you could come out of the dugout, if you were fortunate enough to be in one, until the next shell arrived.
Did you have many casualties, you know, to deal with from these shells?
Well, relatively, I suppose, not more perhaps than 30 killed in the first day's shelling, but very unfortunately, the second or third shell to come in fell quite close to our headquarters and hit the headquarters of a signal unit that had only come in the day before. And that killed a lot of fine young men in the signal department, and wounded quite a number of others.
What was your service, you know, your ambulances, were you able to cope with the number of casualties, do you think? Were you able to get them to hospitals?
Oh, yes, I think we were, just about, yes. Yes, I think so. At night time it used to be a little difficult to find one's way to the various camps. I remember driving across the dunes, sand dunes, knowing somewhere there was a large labour camp of Chinese, and all of a sudden I found right in front of me, the raid was over and I had a limited amount of light, and there was a row of Chinese eyes looking at me from out of the ground. But I met a young Cockney who guided me to the scene of the bomb burst that was at night. He was in a flood of tears, poor chap. He said shell had burst amongst his horses and killed and wounded most of them, and he was terribly upset at seeing the horses suffer like that. Well, shall we have tea at that point?
That's a good idea. As well as the civilian casualties, were you dealing with soldiers, you know, the military?
Oh, yes.
Yes, I wonder if you could tell me about that. You know, what area were you going up to the front? Or were you meeting trains coming back from the front?
I was responsible for the ambulance unit, for an artillery unit working close to the front, but the Newport front was entirely waterlogged and there was no trench system there, which was very good. But I think I mentioned that one of our main jobs, we're not doing actual ambulance work, one or other of the members of our team had to pick the colonel in charge of Dunkirk and take him on his rounds, to call on the various medical depots, and that involved spending one week in every four or five in the little village of Bruges behind... No, I'm sorry, it isn't Bruges. Oh dear, I've forgotten its name. It's certainly not Bruges. Small inland village, practically devoid of civilians, and we lived in a rather derelict house in the village. I share the room with the colonel's batman, and he used to sleep downstairs and we slept upstairs. And on one fine night, I did my best to set the whole place on fire. One had to feed oneself entirely, except midday. We went to a sergeant's mess at midday, but the evening meal I cooked on a primer stove. The stove gave out, and I tried to refill it with a paper cone, pouring petrol, I think, into it. The paper cone collapsed, and the thing went up in a... all the petrol in it caught fire at once, and a lot of Christmas decorations in one corner of the room which had been left behind, and the fire ran across the floor and started burning that. I fortunately had a thick British warm overcoat, and I managed to beat the flames out, but I burnt all the skin off the back of my hand, and was glad I didn't burn the whole village down, because it was a house in a row of very old houses, and nobody living in any of them.
How did the military treat you? You know, knowing that you would have been pacifists, COs.
I never had any trouble at all, even in the sergeant's mess. And the colonel, was most appreciative of our work, and was determined to send to headquarters a recommendation that I and one other member of our squad of six should be presented with a military medal for bravery. But there the thing came unstuck. The headquarters red tab gentlemen weren't going to give a medal to a member of the FAU, and they excused themselves for not doing it by saying they were not giving any more medals to members working in base areas. Well, that was nothing but a wangle, because I was billeted in what was technically a frontline area, doing quite a lot of work in the frontline area, as well as the base. But three months later, he recommended his sergeant for a medal. The sergeant was well known as being one of the first to dive for the deepest dugout the moment any trouble arose. And doing entirely desk work in the base. So it only showed that I and the other member of the unit were so to speak not fairly dealt with by British Army headquarters.
Were you involved in any way with the ambulance trains?
What?
Were you involved in any way with the ambulance trains?
Train? No, not really. I visited them occasionally when they were in the Dunkirk area. I had friends working on the train.
With your ambulances, what service did you give to the people, the casualties you picked up? How many people could you take in an ambulance? How were they sort of fitted out?
Walking cases, walking wounded, um,
Did you have
about eight cases? There were stretchers for four. And that was after we got some new GMC cars provided, I think, by the Canadian Red Cross. I started with a very antique converted ambulance when first I got there, and then after a few months half a dozen of these new GMCs were
GMC stand for? What did it mean, GMC?
General Motors Company of America.
And they were good, were they?
Of their kind, they were good. They gave you very little weather protection. There was no windscreen. You just had a sheet, which canvas sheet, which you pulled up, and the rain would drive in, hit the back of the wooden back of the ambulance, and form a pool on the seat. I remember once on a very blustery winter's night, I went down to Boulogne to fetch a Harley Street specialist who'd been sent for to deal with eye cases in the Chinese camp. And we set off for Dunkirk in the dark. There were howling howling breeze coming in from the North Sea and torrents of rain. After about half an hour, this gentleman said, "I've had enough. I'm going to get into the back of your ambulance. I'm sorry for you chaps. Exposed as you are, you will pay for it later on, I'm afraid." And I suppose I have, because of the arthritis. Was probably brought on by that, and occasionally sleeping in funny places. Though I was nearly always able to sleep in my ambulance, which was a good thing.
The troops, the people you picked up, the casualties, did you ever have to treat them? Did you have to give them medical help? Or were you just drivers, transporters?
Army casualties, practically never. Civilians, yes, occasionally I did.
Were you able to cope? Could you do that?
I think I was fairly competent at it, actually. After the war, I was complimented by a surgeon at the Reading Hospital. I treated a fellow with a very badly broken leg on the road outside Reading. I strapped him up so that the bones wouldn't move any further, and took him into the Reading Hospital, and he took the trouble to find out who I was and send me a message saying I'd probably saved this fellow's life by giving him skilled attention on the roadside. But that was nothing to do with the war.